Alrighty, guys, it's Nicholas Denger back from Waking Gains. Today we've got a brand new podcast coming at you, podcast number 11. This one's going to be a solo podcast, me and myself. Going to go over some new topics today based on, basically we're going to have a longer research corner for the day because we're not going to have a guest as we're transitioning to a new style of podcast. So today on Waking Gains, research corner is going to be the big deal. First, let's go over a little update of how I'm doing. Currently, I am 230 body weight. I'm going to go through a small cut in the next coming weeks where I go down to pretty much, hopefully, by the end of the summer, around 215, 210 area. Currently, my strength sits at a 405 max deadlift, but a daily minimum now is 365. So hopefully by the end of the summer, maybe I can get to a 405 daily minimum. My squat is sitting at about a 315 pause squat as a kind of hard daily minimum. I feel like more like an RPE 9 or 10. And bench is about a 205 daily minimum at about like an RPE 9 or 10. Those numbers aren't exactly impressive. The 315 squat pause is awesome for me, but currently when it comes to the bench, I'm very much lacking in that department. I feel like it's going to be awesome when I can actually do 225 reps. And this week I actually hit a minimum of 135 on the military press for a daily minimum. And that was awesome. It really, really showed the benefits that I've come through doing daily lifts. The military press has been one that I've kind of been kind of sluggish on, kind of scared on, because it is more of a difficult lift. When it comes to the actual gains I've received, they've been increasingly mental to my shoulder health and shoulder stability. So a little bit out of the way, let's go over what videos came out today. So a video came out yesterday called my May training update. Pretty much goes over all these PRs in a nutshell, but the one thing I really want to emphasize when it comes to this then is that video was called May Training Block Update, and it focused on my entire May progress from April to May. So one of the biggest things to focus on in that May block was that I increased pretty much my daily minimums all around by about 20 pounds. Pretty awesome. I've started incorporating pendlay rows because I feel like I want to gain a more breaking inertia style lifting. Breaking your inertial style lifting is kind of a made-up turn I've made so far, but it's essentially like starting a force from a dead stop pause, and that's the huge benefit that I want to pursue for this coming training block, because I want to get into boxing for my cut. One of the key things I'm going to try and do is incorporate a lot of boxing or a lot of cardio, and I think one of the coolest things for boxing is if I can get like a right hook or like a jab extremely strong. Even I'm not going to compete because I don't want to, you know, go unconscious, but I feel like getting my strength, a huge strength base going, will help increase my strength overall. So today, the Douche's Corner is going to be the big highlight, since that's all the news from me. So the first thing we're going to go over today is a talk on obesity and the future of food policies that promote health diets. This is a increasingly interesting topic as people become in the idea of like fat acceptance, or as that becomes more of a mainstream culture. So obesity and the future of food policies that promote health diets is essentially more of an opinion piece paper. It's not a paper that is specific in its intention to actually have a solution. It's more of a bringing more subject matter into light terms. So what the study goes is, the paper is an opinion piece. I already said that. The paper goes over how policies act at a macro level of change and trickle down to micro levels. So essentially it's trying more of to cause more education, because the paper goes over to describe that education on food is probably the most beneficial thing for making a sustainable change. And do I think food policies should be enacted in certain things? I think in more government-funded or municipality things, I think there should be certain food policies, maybe like school kids or cafeteria lunches. Definitely don't need to have like a pizza from your local fast food place or burgers. Change it out to homemade food or things like that. So I think those kind of food policies would be good. Maybe more education, because the current education, like the food groups or other policies like that, really don't give way to proper knowledge I think people really deserve when it comes to this. So back to the paper, it comes with two overall infographics, and you can find the full versions over the links provided at the website awakeninggains.com. There'll be more of an in-depth written view of the podcast there. So the study goes over two overall graphs. One is talking about the macro levels of food policies, and one's talking about the food policies. One's talking about the cycle of how diet influences someone's health. So one of the cool things I found while reading it was understanding that the macro changes to food impact someone's micro levels a lot. And that kind of makes sense. Macro levels mean pretty much talking about the broadest sense, while the micro levels are the small minutia. So we talked about the macro levels. If we enact food policies that promote certain things like having schools or universities promote certain lunches, it can trigger down to the institutional effects that cause a lot of people to have more more stringent policies. So the obesity and future food policies that promote health diets is an interesting piece. If you want just get knowledge on that idea, it's kind of cool like that, but it doesn't actually give a specific reason to why a food policy should be in place, more of a educational promotion. And that's about it. The paper had no financial biases, so it's not like this paper was politically driven to be liberal or Republican or any other demographic. So pretty good study overall, or paper overall. That's more like the, I guess, the easy one for everyone to read right now. Now we're going to get into some of the more more fun ones or more exciting ones. So that was obesity and the future of food policies that promote health diets. So thank you for the writers of that paper. That was the first study for Research Corner. Second study is pretty crazy. Satellite cell activation and MTR motor signals pathway response to resistance and combined exercise in elite weightlifters. Pretty crazy. Increasingly, in the Awakening Gains podcast, I'm going over a lot of theory and a lot of videos, so I'm going over a lot more exercise fundamental breakdowns. One of the cool things about each of these, I try to give a little bit of nugget at the end. This actual podcast, Podcast 11 on the EWG Life podcast, has many nuggets in it, and that's going to be pretty cool for a transcribed version or any other republishing of this current podcast, because there's so much knowledge to be gained from this, and I really want to promote that as the Awakening Gains brand. The Awakening Gains brand is a brand about breaking fitness limits, is my key, is my slogan. It's about getting knowledge and education through physiology, understanding how things work, and how you can incorporate that to your own knowledge and your own understanding of how things work. So satellite cell activation, MTR, motor signaling, pathway response, resistance, and combined exercise in elite lifters. The study is not a meta-analysis. I want to preface that first. And instead is a question-oriented experiment. Question-oriented experiment means more like they have a hypothesis or they've had an idea that's come up in the past. So this appears to be more like someone's thesis paper, but it was very well done. The question that researchers were attempting to answer is, what mode of resistance training triggers the most anabolic response at the molecular levels in athletes? Pretty crazy. Pretty much they were comparing two different modes of experiments, being resistance training and combined exercises. The resistance training focused three sets of six reps at someone's 60%. So it's kind of like a 5x5. If you incorporate the intensity to be the same, they wanted to make sure the intensity was key on all levels because they didn't want volume to be a trigger for, they didn't want volume to be an outside trigger. So essentially what they were trying to do is they're trying to see what is the most anabolic lifting, I guess, which is pretty crazy. Knowing this little fact can really help people when it comes to understanding how their body reacts to certain stimulus, because if I can do more anabolic lifting, well, I can get to my gains, I can get to my goals faster of a muscle and strength, right? So this is why it's such a golden nugget for you guys, the listeners of the AWG Live podcast. And I hope everyone right now listening made it beyond the Instagram Live, the YouTube Live, the Anchor, as it's reposted, Apple Podcast, Opencast, Overcast, Pocket Radio, hopefully Google Play, and Spotify soon, or no, SoundCloud soon, that you subscribe now so we hear future content like this, because the AWG Live podcast is growing. We've had a lot of profound response, and I really appreciate everyone. So if you subscribe now, let's get on to the golden nugget. Essentially, the two modes of experiments were either resistance training or combined exercise. The participants were given, the participants were around 20-year-old men, give or take 4 years ago, the experiment said, and their BMI was kind of high, but it was also give or take like 6. So it was about 27, give or take 6. So people could be 21 to like 30, I guess. But these were elite lifters overall, or elite athletes like football players. They wanted to see at the molecular level what is the most anabolic exercise. So at the molecular level, what they did was they took basically kind of like a needle, and they extract muscle tissue from your vastus lateralis. Kind of crazy. What it means is they take like a little probe and they scrape off a piece of your muscle. So when it comes to finding out the most molecular anabolic exercises, they did this to experiment on a couple different resistance training or mRNA pathways. The things they were looking for were the KIC7 group, which is kind of crazy. I really don't know how to pronounce that. CD56PI3K and the AKT protein expression of the MTR protein analysis expression. All these are essentially anabolic metabolites, and they wanted to see what levels of this were higher in the muscle biopsies for the most anabolic exercise. So what they combined was resistance training versus combined exercises, and I didn't preference what combined exercise really means. Combined exercising essentially means taking multiple different plyometric exercises and combine them into one. So what they do, like push-ups, dips, and squats, is one combined exercise. And they wanted to make sure the intensities between both groups were the exact same, so not confuse them. So what was the results? So the resistance training wasn't exactly defined in the initial paper I saw. Probably in the full version, it'll be there. But essentially, the results were in the resistance training alone with, I'm assuming, barbell exercises compared to the combined exercises of plyometrics, the anabolic response was about 3 to 4 times higher in all of the protein expressions. So, but it's kind of painful. I did it right. You have to take a little chunk of your muscle out, which is kind of crazy. But if you look at the actual percentages on the full paper, which will be live on the awakeninggains.com, on the AWG podcast sidebar, the actual percentages were like 200 versus 400, 100 versus 400%. So people doing plyometrics can still get an anabolic response from it. But when it comes to the most anabolic response or the most traction of these specific enzymes, doing resistance training has found to be the most efficient for triggering the responses. And this was even when volume and intensity were equated. I think that's pretty unreal, because the reason they want to do it was because if volume was higher in one, well, obviously it would cause a more anabolic effect, because another paper I'm going to talk about next is why volume is so important for driving anabolic responses. But when it comes to this paper, they want to see if, let's say, the squat versus chin-ups, dips, and pull-ups all in the same exercise for the same intensity, the squat triggered a more anabolic response of these specific mRNA protein synthesis. And the reason why they prefaced the mRNA was because the mRNA transcribing is because it takes those mRNA transcribings to make new muscle protein. So when their muscle, or even resynthesize the muscle they've done because of protein folding or protein turnover. Protein turnover is when your muscles eventually use their own proteins, amino acids, for energy, and they leave pretty much like 80% of it there, and they want to put back that other 20%. Well, it takes mRNA to rebuild those protein levels by transcribing new ones from the amino acids in your gut. So they really want to see what type of signals were most created there. And so one could say that maybe perhaps in the study that the resistance training was causing the most degeneracy of amino acids, causing the most benefit. But if you're looking at the idea of muscle damage, that's kind of what you want. So the study can go on. I might make an entire video on this, because I feel like it's such a cool topic. And thank you at Still the Original Dom for your comments on Instagram. It's very much appreciated. This is a transcribed version from the AWG Live podcast. We're live on Instagram at the moment. So this is back to Research Corner for the study. I think I want to make an entire video on this, because if people can really if it really puts in a nail in the coffin between why resistance training is such a prominent thing for promoting the most muscle gain a person can do, because I'm going to go into detail later on next video on why these specific signals are so important. So that was the second study for Research Corner. The paper had no financial bias reported. Like, they were, it said that they were neutral in all stances, which is really good, because if they were financially biased, it would kind of ruin the whole validity of it. Because what if they were hawking some supplement that their supplement combined with all these resistance training caused the most anabolic signal? So I want to preference now in all the studies going forward, the initial biases of the paper. There was one where we talked about the keto diet. The reason we used it was because the keto diet in that specific paper was had they were given a supplement from an Atkins group. We should have preferenced that because it makes sense, Atkins, keto, paleo, right? The paper's still valid because of, well, the reason we used it was because it was so heavily weighed to one side that when it came to the high-carb diet versus the keto diet, essentially they had pretty much the same weight loss results besides the water weight. So even with the supplement included from the Atkins group. So I want to preference that now. I want to be a little bit more I will be extremely transparent with this podcast because I want to give such great knowledge, such great information to everyone that when it comes to forefront or afterwards or actually hearing from this or hearing the transcribed version and learning from it, there's so much knowledge to be learned from it because it's so information packed. So that was the second study from the AWG Live podcast. At the end, we'll go over it one more time in Research Corner just to give a further cementing of it. So let me get a glass of water. Okay, so here's that other study talking about why volume is so important. So volume for muscle hypertrophy and health outcomes, the most effective variable in resistance training. This one is a very interesting paper. It talks about why volume is so important for specific problems and specific people. The initial paper is more of an opinion piece or an opinion-oriented piece. It doesn't actually solve, or there actually isn't a clinical trial going on. It's more of a collection of, you can't really call it a meta-analysis. It's kind of like that. It goes over like 50 references from other studies. And for anyone who wants to do research on these things, if you look at references that studies have gone through, there's so much information. When it comes to compiling these videos and finding all the research for this, I look at probably like 5 or 6 journals. And that's just in the May stuff and June stuff. Like when it comes to like going 10 years back, there's going to be so much information that hasn't been covered in the world of fitness that I feel like bringing this into light will be a huge benefit for everyone listening because, man, even just hearing that last study of how resistance training is so anabolic in its initial mRNA transcription, just because of the metrics involved, that if just knowing that forefront, you don't have to waste time doing planks, you don't have to waste time doing other things. Focus on the resistance exercise first and do those afterwards because they still have an effect, but focus on the most beneficial exercises, like learning that at an actual molecular level, that these are things, it isn't just some gym bro knowledge, is super knowledgeable and super beneficial to everyone listening. So volume for muscle hypertrophy and health outcomes, the most effective variable in resistance training. Again, this paper is more of an opinion piece or an opinion oriented idea. The goal of this paper is to enlighten the reader on the thresholds of volume for both muscle hypertrophy and health promotion. What that essentially means is the thresholds for volume is the idea that certain people can only take so much exercise. It's not overreaching because the real phrase for overreaching is kind of like a hot topic where it's debated as in, is it for elite lifters or is it for beginners? Because overreaching to me isn't the definition that kind of elite athletes use. Elite athletes use overreaching when they're at their peak, their prime, and they're procuring their best to be the best, but they're also going in a little bit extra they can recover from to like a competitive advantage because they're so elite and they're actually physically burnt out. They're actually using all their energy. I think overreaching is more like a general definition where sometimes I've felt it where you're not recovering properly and you kind of feel like a huge, like you kind of hit a wall. I kind of feel like a huge, not a burn, but a huge pain sensation or like a adrenal fatigue, I like to call it. Where you're not as high energy because you know that you've dipped too far into your recovery. So, back to the paper. The volume for muscle hypertrophy and health promotion. Health promotion is the second key article for this paper. Health promotion has not really been viewed, I guess, in the fitness community online because health promotion has kind of been like a secondary thing. Sure, everyone wants to gain muscle and size, right? And those do have health benefits like better blood flow, warding off osteoporosis, diabetes, helping to maintain people's blood sugar, like things like that, even some cancer benefits, cancer fighting benefits. But health promotion has been more of a sidestep topic, and I want to bring that more to the forefront. So muscle hypertrophy and health promotion, putting those together, it kind of frames the article in a more objective viewpoint because putting both together kind of makes muscle hypertrophy less of a total goal, because if it's because health is more like homeostasis, where it's kind of like the perfect range of all things, where you don't really overreach, you don't really overextend, you more promote all the benefits you can get without causing negative effects. So, excuse me. So what they wanted to do was they take they're trying to explain to people for because of the health promotion, they want to explain to people what is the most effective volume for beginners or who don't have a lot of time. When it comes to people not having a lot of time at the gym, it's very much an important thing because if you can't go to the gym, but you still want the health benefits, i.e. the health benefits in muscle hypertrophy, you have to find the most effective minimum volume. And I think before I've read other papers where it's about 10 sets a week. I think a couple articles before I've talked about that, where pretty much if you do like 10 work sets on a given exercise a week, you get pretty much the most, like 90% of the muscle presses you could actually do. I'm talking about work sets, real work sets, not like warm-ups, but warm-ups do count, but they're not going to be counted for the entire thing. So back to the paper. The paper doesn't actually mention what the minimum effective dosage is for people. It more brings along the idea. So the paper tries to make a stark difference between muscle hypertrophy and health promotion, because health promotion can have a huge benefit to the general population, because the obesity is on a large rise. It kind of plays into the first one: should there be food policies? I think food policies should only really be intact for nutrition labels or municipality organizations. So back to the paper. So the real important thing is trying to educate people on the minimum effective dosages for their health promotion. So they talked about volume being the key thing, because volume in a lot of other studies, like in the one mentioned before about the DNA, volume was the key thing, because if volume was too high, it was going to cause more of an anabolic response. So tying all these together, if you found the minimum effective dosage for your given exercise health benefits, say you just wanted to lower your cardiovascular risk disease and you wanted to increase your muscle hypertrophy. First, using resistance training to get the most anabolic response for your muscle hypertrophy, and then focusing on cardio is probably going to be your best bet, even though there has been like knowledge for a given amount of time that just incorporating a lot of different exercises is going to have the most beneficial. But really trying to understand why that occurs is going to be the most beneficial for everyone long term, because it actually gives knowledge for you, the person trying to do it. And for me, right now, I'm a university of, you know, university student, going through his human kinetics degree, and going through all these research papers right now is giving me a fountain of knowledge for a fountain of knowledge for when it comes to incorporating all this information to my life after this, after university, because it's going to give me so much understanding of why all these health benefits occur. So that was the third study, kind of like a more miscellaneous one, like the first one. It's meant to be more of like a transition piece. The full write-up will be on awakengains.com. So the fourth study, the effects of single amino acid deficiency on mRNA translation are marked differently for methionine versus leucine. The title pretty much gives it away. The difference between, so this is a really weird one. People always get into the minutiae about like BCAAs and if they're getting enough protein. So this is more like a, or even that vegans are protein deficient. This one is a interesting paper, because it really puts into account on a molecular level what would happen if you were deprived of amino acids, specifically leucine versus methionine, which were the biggest ones. There were other ones later on the paper that didn't have exactly the biggest benefits, biggest outcomes. So they did like a petri dish experiment where they cultured, what was the word? They cultured HEK293T cells. Unfortunately, I do not know what type of organ or environment they come from, but they appear to be either muscle cells or some type of DNA responsive cell for muscle building, because they're doing it for leucine and methionine. So they had lots of different studies. So let's go over all the different ones they tried to lower right now. They wanted to have a deficiency, and so what they did was they had this cell. They fed it a specific blend of amino acids, and each specific blend had one missing, essentially. So they're missing leucine in one, methionine in another, histidine in another, arginine, and those are pretty much the four. The metrics we're looking for, IF2 and, oh god, these DNA words really need to be like nicer words, because literally there's letters and numbers put together, and you can say that about all letters really, but literally just letters and numbers put together. So I'm looking for IF2, 4EBP1 phosphorylation, and mRNA transcription levels. Their findings were that methionine-starved cells had the greatest impact on protein synthesis levels assessed by pyrimycium-labeled polypeptide levels. Polypeptide levels are found primarily in peptides, as in like protein levels or certain amino acids. So they found that methionine-starved cells had the greatest impact on protein synthesis because methionine is an important regulatory response for building of new muscle tissue cells. So kind of makes sense that if you're starved of methionine, you'd have a problem creating new polypeptides in the body through mRNA transcription, where leucine-starved cells had mixed results, showing that the metrics had an inconsistent manner, because when they're doing the Petri dish in the full write-up, it talked about how even though that the cells were starved, they had mixed results from each starved cell. So some cells had a lot lower mRNA transcription, so they're less able to write, they're less efficient at writing code, because, well, leucine is an important amino acid for transcribing leucine is a very important amino acid for transcribing new DNA code, because it's one of the essential amino acids, and it has a very strong nitrogen balance finish efficiency. So the starved cells had polypeptides, but the paper concludes that if more research should be done on the subject, as a larger lack of understanding is what's holding back the paper. learning that the real results of methionine starvation or amino acid starvation is really beneficial for understanding your knowledge on human physiology in general. I do want to make a video eventually on what all these different levels of mRNA transcription actually mean, like 4EBPI1 phosphorylation. A couple of these can be like huge nuggets of information that literally no one knows about, and the people writing the paper knew what it was, but because people always get into crazy. The reason I want to bring this up is not because the paper is inconclusive or more talked about a hypothetical situation, because this paper is very much a hypothetical situation, because all foods pretty much except gelatin have a complete amino acid profile, from grass to bananas, all right, and from milk to cheese, they all have a complete amino acid profile. So when it comes to the reason I'm even talking about this, is because people get way too caught up on if I'm getting enough BCAAs or if I'm getting enough protein in general. These starvation cells, even though they were starved of certain things, they were still able to function properly. They're still able to do mRNA transcription because the body would create other ones. Even though these are essentially somewhat essential amino acids, mRNA transcription can continue even though they're not present, which is pretty important. The study didn't exactly go over what this would be like in human trials. It kind of almost be like impossible. Like you'd have to pretty much you pretty much have to feed someone just whey protein. But even though whey has these, like, all, how would you even do this in like a human trial? You'd have to just feed them BCAAs that are isolated out of the certain amino acids. So it'd be pretty unreal to see as an actual human trial, and probably when I come to human trials, this is more like, because they use a Petri dish, right? It isn't ethically sound from a study point. So even though that this study showed that mRNA transcription was lowered in methionine and leucine starved groups, it shows that you don't need to really worry about this ever really happening to you. Unless you don't eat enough calories in general, then you have to worry. But if you need enough calories every day and you need enough variety of food, you're going to hit your protein levels pretty well. Very cool nugget of knowledge. This one almost deserves its own video. What would happen if you were starved on methionine and leucine? This video shows a very good amount of light into the topic of research and physiology. So I really want to feature that on the AW Live podcast over at Awakened Gains. So, last one out of the bunch is called Deficiency of PRK2D Triggers Hyperinsulinemia and Metabolic Disorders. This is the third kind of like theory-based scientific paper that talks about... First, let's preface this. The study was not done on humans. It was done on monkeys and rats. Rhesus monkeys, to be specific. I believe they're like the closest DNA-wise to humans, rhesus monkeys, something along those lines. The goal of this paper is to better understand the relationship between PRK2D2 and the effects of metabolic disorder. Metabolic disorder is essentially a fancy word for saying that your cells are becoming insulin resistant. PRK2D is essentially protein kinase. I believe that's the term that the paper talked about. Essentially another word for protein kinase. Or a... this is very tricky. There's a lot of very fancy words in this. Paper sort of is rather complex. The paper essentially the monkeys in the trial had a PRK... They forced the monkeys in the trial to have a PRK2D mutation that decreased the mRNA levels present. And when mRNA levels decreased, they started having metabolic disorders and thus hyperinsulinemia. This is more better, this is kind of, that was the first trial. It was better found in the rats where they talked about how they forced a downregulation of mRNA. So they didn't go through the whole gene mutation thing. They went from a downregulation of mRNA, which caused a larger secretion of beta cells. And the reason this was caused was because the beta cells, the reason why this caused a metabolic disorder is because increased beta cells in someone's pancreas causes more insulin to be created. So they forced in the rats to have a deficiency in the PRK2D trigger. So they pretty much had like a blend of food they were eating, but they deleted them. That's what it was. The freight was deleted. They didn't have a deficiency, but technically, it's a deficiency because it's not present. They deleted the PRK2D cells or nutrients in their body in certain areas, and they probably had like radiation to figure out what was happening. So, when these cells were taken away from them or the deficiency occurred, it caused a metabolic disorder because the insulin, your beta cells in your pancreas, started upregulating its mRNA started upregulating beta cells, which caused beta cells to create more insulin, and insulin, and what greater presence of insulin to do less work caused insulin resistance in many different cells, lipid bilayers. So, kind of crazy of a study. The animal models in the study were given an artificial environment to have these symptoms, which is very important. This didn't occur in actual clinical trials, but they did note that this mutation in the monkeys is something of note because perhaps this could be a reason or be a leading cause of how diabetes forms in some people, where perhaps they have this mutation of the PRK2D2 mRNA level or gene, which causes a insulin resistance to certain things by down-regulating one's mRNA, down-regulating one mRNA to cause the beta cell influence. So I think I might have got the little bit of terminology mixed up. I'll have a better write up on the AW Live or the awakengains.com. So sorry about that. That was the first five podcast, the first five of the research corner today. So let's kind of do a little recap of all of it before we head out. Eventually I want to do it on the site. I want to get like a not a subscription service, but more of a newsletter style. So if you guys are down for that, put some comments down below in the YouTube or Instagram or our anchor. You can even email me on the website's link for the email. So the key things learned, or the important things learned from this podcast, is there's a lot of studies talking about the theories of why things are and the benefits that you can learn from learning this. So when it comes to the satellite cell activation and the MTR sensing of the anabolic response versus plyometrics versus resistance training or combined exercises, learning or at least understanding from a surface level why your exercise selection is so important to causing, why your exercise selection is so important and its effects. So things like the deadlift. Deadlift is pretty much exercise that has the most amount of weight on it and the fullest range of motion. understanding that the deadlift causes, I don't know if they did the deadlift experiment, but understanding that if I do the deadlift versus I do back planks to increase my back strength, or I do air squats instead of a barbell squats, learning the actual anabolic difference for someone's goals is going to be a huge thing for increasing their overall growth in that certain lift. So when it comes to actually understanding your knowledge, understanding at a even at a molecular level, they literally ripped the muscles out of people with a little like gun or a little like kind of like a needle, took it out, examined it, and found that even at a macro level, their gene expressions were totally different than the group that had the combined exercises. So really focusing on your resistance exercises first can be the best for if your results are to be increased muscle hypertrophy, even increased strength. And then it comes to the third study, volume as the most effective variable in resistance training. We're really talking about how even if you can't come to the gym multiple times a day, try to increase the overall volume of in your lifts. So if someone could do, let's say, if the goal for every week, pretty much for every work set, is 10 per week, you can go 3 times, 3 days a week, do three work sets, three work sets, three work sets, and maybe on the fourth, and maybe on one day you add like an extra one to it as for fun. Understanding your minimum effective dosage for each lift, because volume is essentially just another word for mechanical work. People always kind of forget this when it comes to partials versus full range of motion lifts. The reason full range of motion lifts have the most effect on people is because the actual work is significantly more. The actual work done is significantly more because it's amount of leverages, distance over force. So when it comes to actually understanding that volume, increasing one's volume means increasing one's work, increases more leverage and more muscle actual mechanical tension. It's going to be the key thing. So that's a third nugget in this podcast, kind of the crazy one, the effects of amino acid deficiency. Understanding that even if you are deficient in certain amino acids for a very short amount of time, you could still your body still functions at its mRNA levels. It functions at its DNA construction. It still functions at its protein synthesis. Sure, things are starting down regularly, but if you're eating throughout the day, doesn't really matter if it's like 2 or 3 hours. I think I did another study about how much protein do you need, and they talked about in there that 100 grams was pretty much the 90% mark, and then if you really want to, like 120 was pretty much like 99%. I talk about protein timing, where I think the most effective was almost like 4 hours apart, 4 or 3 hours apart for the most optimal like protein synthesis, but it didn't matter what specific grams. It was more like 20, 20, 20, 20, 20 in little bits of chunks to cause the most all the day. But as long as you eat enough calories in a day, you're going to be fine for amino acid deficiency because all foods contain amino acids besides gelatin, pretty much a complete amino acid profile of leucine, methionine, and arginine, histidine, and all the other ones, glutamine. So even here's another bonus. Even the other ones that weren't even looked at, like that were looked at in the study, in their deficiency levels were. Where was it? It was deficiencies in a petri dish that are caused by. Sorry, I'm looking at my show notes right now. The other ones I looked at, so I looked at methionine, leucine, arginine, and histidine. Examining multiple different protein deficiencies to find that most of them didn't really affect mRNA transcription, but the ones that did were the methionine affected protein synthesis. So if you're low on methionine, and you want to build muscle, you probably have to eat more methionine. But this is also examples where there's absolutely none. So if you eat, you're fine. But you don't have to worry about too about like BCAAs because oh, what if I get more of this? Would it affect my mRNA levels? Maybe in a follow-up a podcast, I'll talk about maybe if I can find a study talking about additional BCAAs on mRNA levels at a molecular level. But a lot of the studies have found no conclusive benefit to even like a percentile difference with muscle mass when it comes to ingesting BCA. So I doubt that'd actually be I doubt that'd be an actual a team ready to go for that kind of paper. But the fourth one, hyperinsulinemic metabolic disorder. This one's kind of it's more of a theory paper. It didn't apply to a lot of people in the like the health and fitness community, but it applies to overall like the general physiology knowledge. So even though it was in reasons, even though it was rodents, trying to learn what causes a metabolic disorder in people. So perhaps with this PARK2 protein kinase, this lack of protein splitting. So protein kinase is kind of like it adds molecules to other molecules going through mRNA transcription. So if this is lower, if you can't add those extra molecules to certain proteins, it helps build proteins together through the mRNA chain. If you somehow get a metabolic disorder where this is lowered, you're probably likely going to have an onset of diabetes over time because your pancreas and insulin levels will keep rising. So all of this is so that people get more educated on health and fitness overall. If you enjoyed the podcast, like and subscribe. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to the channel, even subscribe to the email on the podcast, because there's so much knowledge and so much information that I want to give to everyone in the health and fitness community. I really want to break some fitness limits. That's the slogan for the channel. And I hope you all enjoyed the podcast. This has been Nicholas Denninger from Waking Gains signing off. If you enjoyed, like, subscribe, comment. See you in the next one, Awakened Gains.